Well, it's difficult for us in the Western world to appreciate just how important temples were in the ancient world. The importance of them was almost as prevalent in paganism as it was in Judaism. So much so that through the Roman Empire, desecration of a temple, any temple, was a capital offence. And it's hard for us to imagine that in this day of scrawling graffiti, of spraying paint on buildings, and the general disrespect that there is for the sacred or for the memorial, that defaming a temple would be treated so seriously. But that's the way it was. By such laws, the Roman Empire was not necessarily trying to be wonderfully pious. In part, it was just trying to hold itself together. You see, the Romans sometimes engaged in what we call god swaps. When they conquered some new territory, they would insist that the conquered territory would accept some of the gods in the Roman pantheon, and the Romans would adopt some of the gods in the conquered territory and bring them back to Rome. And the reason being, in their minds, was that the people that are most likely to rebel, the people that are most likely to cause the Roman army most trouble, are those who associate kinship and land and religion all together. And if they could break up any of that, then there was less opportunity for rebellion. So the way that they broke up one element of that, the religious side of things, was to engage in this god swap. If some of the gods of these conquered people were now Roman gods, and some of the gods of these people were now in Rome being honoured by the Romans, then there was less chance of rebellion. Partly because of this, and partly because of superstition, it was common in the ancient world to actually execute people for the desecration of a temple. Now, the Jews, who had inherited the Old Testament revelation, had even far stronger reasons for revering the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. This was the temple, and Zion was the hill, and Jerusalem was the city where God had chosen to make himself known, right from the time of King David onwards. And from their point of view, this wasn't just sacred history. This was a place where God himself came down every year on the Day of Atonement. It was the time when the high priest went into the most holy place, carrying the blood of animals, and made atonement for the sins of the people. And God was expected to appear. This was the meeting place with God. Now, Muslims today speak of Mecca as being the sacred place, and every respectable Muslim is supposed to make a valiant effort each year to get to Mecca, or at least one time in their life to be able to go and visit this holy city. But Mecca is nothing like the compelling power that Jerusalem had for Jews. Not only should Jews try to go to Jerusalem, but Jerusalem was the very centre point of their religion. It was the very focus of their religion. And again, I think it's hard for us to understand that today. Partly because we don't think of temples in the same way. And partly because the Jews today gather together to meet in synagogues. They don't have a temple. They don't have a sacrificial system. They don't have a high priestly service anymore. And as a result, contemporary Judaism is a long way off from the Judaism of the first century. But for those Jews, it brought to mind the Exodus. It brought to mind for them Moses and the law. It brought to mind to them the tabernacle. It brought to mind all of the specific commands of how the temple should be built. It brought to mind David in Jerusalem, the glory of Solomon. It reminded them of the division of the Davidic Empire after Solomon's death. the destruction of the temple, the going into exile, and then the return of the people and the building again of a second temple. A temple that was just a shadow of the former glory of the temple. And still, this was the place where God would meet his people. And every day there was a morning and an evening sacrifice. 3 times a year the people were to go to the great festivals where thousands of Jews would come from all over the world. And so the temple had come to represent for the Jews more than any church building could ever represent for us today. You know, even somewhere like Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's Cathedral just doesn't enter into the same sort of concept that the Jews had for the temple. It didn't rate as highly because this place was unique. Now, with that background in mind, let's have a look at this discussion of the temple that takes place in John chapter 2. John chapter 2, beginning verse 13. So when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem, like any good Jew would do. And in the temple courts, he found people selling cattle and sheep and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove them from the temple courts, both the sheep and the cattle, and he scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." And his disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Now, the first thing that we need to notice in this passage is that the temple must be cleansed. And from this, there are 2 very important lessons that John wants us to learn. First of all, the worship of God must not be devoured by form. It's important to recognize that at one level, the money changers and the people that had the cattle were, in one sense, doing a service for the people. Jews came from all over the empire, and you wouldn't expect a Jew who was coming up for the Passover to bring sheep with him as they crossed the Mediterranean. Additionally, every Jew over the age of 20, every male Jew, was expected to offer half a shekel of silver per year in support of the temple. But the temple only wanted one kind of currency. You know, then as now, different countries have different currencies, and you have to convert that currency when you go into a different nation. But in Jerusalem, they wanted what was called the Tyrian silver, because it was the purest silver. So you had to convert whatever money you had into that currency. And so these people here were providing a service. Originally, they had set up shop just across the valley on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. And then there had been a place for them in the lower part of the temple complex, out of the way of people going in. But as their business expanded and they wanted a little higher profile, they moved into the court of the Gentiles. And now the business had taken over so much that worship there just wasn't possible. You had the bawling of cattle. You had sheep droppings all over the place that you had to try and work your way through. The money changers were calculating the particular percentage of the time and shouting, "Over here if you want the best deal." How could you possibly worship when all of that was taking place? So the thing itself wasn't wrong, but it had simply taken over in order to keep the forms right. You had to have the right silver. You had to have the right animals in order to sacrifice. The form had taken over so much that any meaningful sense of worship was entirely gone. That's what's happening here. In the Synoptic Gospels at the second cleansing of the temple, Jesus says something like this: "My house shall be a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves." The money changers, you see, were in the Gentile court. The Jewish court, or the court for women, wasn't contaminated. It was the Gentile court that they were operating in. And so instead of the temple being a place for all nations, they made it a den of thieves. In fact, the word can be rendered a den of guerrillas, because it had become a nationalist stronghold. They could still serve the Jews, but the Gentiles were being squeezed out. But here the charge is a little different. In verse 16 it says, "To those who sold doves, he said, 'Get these out of here and stop turning my father's house into a market.'" In other words, they had the formal details right, but they forgot that God has to be worshipped. Now, throughout the Old Testament, you have a similar refrain continually coming up: "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." An acknowledgement of who God is rather than burnt offerings. God actually says, "Your sacrifices and your burnt offerings, well, they're just like a stench in my nostrils." And then later in John's Gospel, we get an even larger vision of what worship is all about. Jesus says the time is going to come when neither at Jerusalem or in Samaria will there be worship. But those who do worship must worship the Father in spirit and in truth. God's worship isn't going to be localized in a temple. Now, this really has an important bearing on the Christian church. Take the church at Corinth, for example. Because we know that there were factions in that church. But yet what we see throughout the book of 1 Corinthians is that Paul adopts a yes but argument. Throughout the letter he's writing yes but. So he'll say things like, yes, it's good for a man not to touch a woman, but it's also good for a man to be married. It's good for a person not to eat food offered to idols. But we know that an idol is nothing, and there's nothing wrong in doing so. He's speaking in tongues. He says, "I speak in tongues more than any of you. But in the church, I'd rather speak 5 words in a known tongue than 10,000 words in an unknown one." There's always the yes, but. That's always part of his argument, because he's attempting to bring the factions together. But when it comes to the Lord's Supper, we have a place in the epistle where he says something quite different. He says, "In what I'm now going to address, I have no praise for you at all." There's no but, only a yes. "Your meetings, well, your meetings do more harm than good." Can you imagine that? The ongoing Christian sacrament of the Lord's Supper, established by Jesus himself, and Paul looks at what's happening and he says, "I can't find anything good to say about the way you're conducting yourself. Nothing at all." In other words, it's possible in our corporate worship of God to look at our meetings and to think they're actually doing more damage than good. That's what the text is telling us. And Jesus treated the corporate worship of the temple in the first century in the same way. Now, Paul warns us about this particular church in Corinth, and inevitably we have to ask ourselves, well, what about us? How does this apply to us? But before we do that, let me just speak about the nature of worship in the Bible for a moment. Because under the Old Covenant, worship was inevitably tied up with the sacrificial system, with the offering of animals, with the temple priests, with the temple rituals, and so on. But in the New Testament, the language of worship changes. Have a look at Romans chapter 12 and the opening two verses. Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. And here Paul says, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. So the nature of sacrifice has changed. It's not a matter of offering animals anymore. It's a matter of offering ourselves as a living sacrifice. One that is holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Now, this type of worship that Paul is describing here is not something that we do for half an hour in church. It's something that we are to be doing all the time. It's bound up with all of our life. In the book of Hebrews, we see that Jesus has offered his blood on our behalf. He is our great high priest. And now we are to offer ourselves up to him all the time. We are to continually offer a sacrifice of praise, the gift of thanksgiving. And then in Romans 15 we see that worship is tied in to evangelism. Now compare that with the way that we often use the word worship today. In the Western world we tend to think of worship as the first part of the service, what we've already done when we've sung a few hymns. All that we do during the week isn't worship. We do our own thing. And then we come to church. And then the first bit of church, well, that's worship. And then the speaker gets up and says a few words. That's not worship. So not only have we restricted worship to the service, we've restricted it to one part of the service. But you see, under the New Covenant, worship is to embrace all of life. It is being God-centered through all of our life, from the moment we get up to the moment we go to sleep. Worship is to be involved in our family relationships. It's to be involved in our values. It's to be involved in how we conduct our business, what we do with our money. In everything that we do, that is what worship is. Now, of course, we come together and there is a sense when we worship corporately. There is a time for corporate singing. There is a time for corporate fellowship. There is a time for corporate instruction. But it's not, well, now we need to do something that we haven't been doing for the rest of the week. We're just doing something corporately that we should have been doing individually all week. Now, if we understand the New Covenant view of worship, it quickly becomes very obvious that if we reduce our understanding of worship to just a small portion of a church service, and then we start to argue over, well, what should proper worship be? Well, proper worship can only mean a piano, not an organ, not a guitar, and certainly not drums. Well, then we seem to have missed the point. If we think we can come together in corporate worship, when in fact we're nurturing bitterness in our heart, and we can't even speak to some people in the church. Or we're sitting here knowing that 31st of January is coming up and we're going to cheat on our tax return that's due. Or we don't have any integrity in our family relationships. And the list can go on and on and on. But actually, we're here today to worship. Then I think Jesus would have something to say to us. And I think he would say, well, look, you've got the form right. You've come here to worship, but actually you've lost the heart of what worship is. And there might be a few things that he'd want to chase out of here too. You see, God isn't interested in the form. He's interested in the reality. Now, the second aspect of the cleansing of the temple is that Jesus is going to suffer. Jesus is going to suffer. John chapter 2 and verse 17. His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And of course, that's a quotation from Psalm 69 and verse 9. And in the Old Testament context, David is suffering. He's being betrayed by his friends. He is made to suffer because those in whom he's put his trust have proved to be untrustworthy. And now Jesus fits that mold. David had such a zeal for the Lord that sometimes it cost him the allegiance and the support of his friends. And it consumed him and it devoured him. Now, from a biblical perspective, those Old Testament pictures of a suffering servant, of a suffering king, of someone who is going to be so devoted to the cause of God that he was going to suffer as a result, they find their ultimate fulfillment in Jesus of Nazareth. Zeal for your house will consume me. It doesn't mean will consume me with zeal. That misses the point. It's because I have the zeal, therefore I'm going to be destroyed by it. I will be consumed by it. I will be burned up by it. And what we're getting here is the first inkling of something that becomes stronger and stronger and stronger throughout all of the gospel accounts. Although the Jews expected a messianic king, they didn't expect a messianic king who was going to be a suffering servant. The disciples, you see, didn't really understand this until much later. But here they remembered Christ's comment and it suddenly began to fall into place. So the temple is cleansed by Jesus at the beginning of his ministry. And from this we can derive two very important points. Jesus insists that the reality of worship is much more important than the form of worship, and we understand that he is going to suffer. Well, next in the passage we see that the temple must be destroyed and be raised again. In verse 18, the Jews then responded to him, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all of this?" So on the one hand, these temple authorities had the right and they had the obligation to challenge the credentials of someone who was going to act like this. But on the other hand, there were plenty of laws on the books to handle any cheap hooligan. If they thought that Jesus was just some hooligan who was going to defame and deface the temple in some way, well, they had ample legal and security resources to deal with that. But that is not their question. It's not as if you have a police officer who comes up to a hooligan who's spraying graffiti on a wall and the police officer says, "By what rights do you have to spray this on that wall?" See, that's not what's going on here. If that was the case, the officer would simply handcuff him and take him off to court. It's not that they thought that Jesus was some sort of hooligan, because they had the resources to deal with that. No, they heard what he had just said previously. They were already witnessing some of his authority. This was a man with moral integrity. And so they couldn't just dismiss him as some cheap hooligan. So inevitably it raised the question. And Jesus' answer to the question is really quite shocking. In verse 19 he says, "Destroy this temple, I will raise it again in 3 days." Now what does that mean? Well, we must learn at least 3 things from what he's saying. First, the temple that Jesus spoke of was his own body. The Jews didn't understand that. They think he's talking about this physical temple that holds so much importance to them. In verse 20, "It has taken us 46 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it in 3 days. And so John comments in verse 21 that the temple he had spoken of was his body. In other words, what John's telling us is that Jesus himself is the ultimate meeting place between God and his people. Because that's what the temple was. The temple was the meeting place under the terms of the Old Covenant where God met with his people. And if Jesus now claims to be that temple, then he's claiming to be the ultimate meeting place between God and his people. Now that is quite an astonishing claim. Suppose you had a preacher. Suppose I got up here today and I said, everything you have ever heard about where to meet God, you know, when you're praying in your private space, or when you're sitting around the Lord's table, or in the meeting together of God's people, forget about all that. You meet with God purely because of me. That's the only way you can meet God, because of me. And if you know me, you know God. Well, if I said that, you'd probably think I was insane. You would want to lock me up as quickly as you could. But that is on a par of what Jesus is saying and claiming again and again in the Gospels. And it really is the way that we can read the Old Testament. You see, in John's Gospel, Jesus is presented for us as the Lamb of God. He's presented as the serpent who's lifted high on a pole. He is presented as the manna, the bread of God. He is presented as the vine. He is presented as the Passover. He is presented as the true Sabbath. And here, he is presented as the temple. Item after item taken out of the Old Testament, and Jesus says all of that was just pointing forward, and it was pointing forward to me, and I'm here now. And so Jesus is saying, if you read the Old Testament correctly, if you see how all of the parts fit together, you'll discover that all of the pieces point in one direction, and that is to me. In other words, Jesus is presenting himself as the key that holds the whole Bible together. That's part of what's happening here. Jesus sees himself as the ultimate meeting place between God and his people. There is no other temple. There is no other sacrifice that will do. Jesus is it. Now, second, what he's showing here is that it is in particular Jesus' death and resurrection that establishes him as the ultimate meeting place between God and his people. See, back in the prologue of John's Gospel that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, in chapter 1 and verse 14, John has already used this terminology of the tabernacle. The word became flesh and tabernacled among us for a while. He tented with us. And so in that announcement, you already have the preliminary themes being brought out. Jesus himself is the tabernacle. Jesus himself is the temple. He is the place where you are going to meet God. And now we go one step further. Not only in his incarnation, not only in who he is as the God-man, is he the temple where we meet with God, but in particular, we meet with God in this temple on account of its destruction and its resurrection. Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. The temple was the place of sacrifice, and Jesus' body is the temple, but he is sacrificed himself. That's why in the New Testament, Jesus is sometimes presented as the priest, the one who offers the sacrifice. Sometimes he is presented as the temple where you meet with God. And sometimes he's presented as the lamb who is sacrificed. You see, all of these various strands of Old Testament thought come together and they meet. They climax in Jesus. They're all brought together in him. Have a look over in John chapter 11. Caiaphas the high priest says something, but he doesn't quite know what it is that he's saying. And so John 11 and verse 50. He says, "You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish." And then John comments rather wrongly. Verse 51. "He did not say this on his own, but as the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and to make them one." In other words, here, at this point, is the ultimate meeting place with God. And it turns on Jesus' death on our behalf. The destruction of his body and then the resurrection of his body again to new life. That's where the plot line in all of the four Gospels is leading us to. That's the journey that the Gospels are taking us on towards the cross and towards the resurrection. And if you find some account of the Gospel that presents Jesus as just a model for our behaviour, or presents Jesus as a spiritual mentor, or as a guru, or a teacher of some rather nice ethical systems that we ought to follow, but not as the temple that's going to be destroyed and built again, then it's simply not the biblical Jesus that's being presented. The third thing that we see here is that Jesus' death and resurrection establish his authority. Look at the logic between those two verses in John chapter 2, verses 18 and 19. "The Jews then responded to him, 'What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all of this?' And Jesus answered them and said, 'Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days.'" Now you see, Jesus isn't changing the subject with his answer. He's not doing what most politicians do. You know, you ask them a question, and they think, "Well, yeah, okay, that's an interesting question. But actually, what I want to talk about is this." And they change the topic and don't answer the question at all. But that's not what Jesus is doing here. He's answering their question exactly. What authority do you have to handle the temple structures that now exist, that have played such an important part in our history and in our civil law. What gives you the authority to do all of this? And Jesus says the ultimate authority is vested in me, and it's going to be demonstrated very boldly, very clearly and very plainly when I've been killed and raised again, and when you see an empty tomb. In other words, Jesus dares to rest his authority on his death and resurrection that was witnessed by thousands of people. Destroy this body and I will raise it again. That's the authority that I have. And at the end of the day, it's important to constantly remember that the disclosure of God in Christ is not some abstract system of thought. It's not like Buddhism. This is grounded in history. This is something that actually took place in time and space. And there were witnesses to it. Real people wrote these things down. Real people were willing to die for this in order to testify and be a witness of it. You see, biblical Christianity doesn't put itself forward as one possibility among many. It puts itself forward as the disclosure of God in real history that was witnessed by real people, and it's something that you cannot simply just take or leave. Well, you can run away from it, you can deny it, you can slander it, you can advance reasons for disallowing it. But you can't simply say, well, it's all very nice and I'll buy a little bit of this from it. I like this part of the system but not that part of the system. I'll choose this little bit but not that little bit. Because it won't let you do that. This is telling you that this is all or nothing. Christianity is not an abstract theoretical system where you can afford to be eclectic. It's the disclosure of God himself in the God-man Jesus Christ that is finally attested to in his resurrection from the dead. A resurrection that was massively witnessed. You cannot escape the history of the resurrection. And as you confront it, if you come to the point where you believe it to be true, then you have to ascribe to Jesus a certain authority over your life. And then a whole lot of things lead on from that. What do you do with someone who claims to be God? And then comes back from the dead to prove who he is. So spend some time reviewing the evidence. What evidence is there for the resurrection? What about the manuscripts that were written within just a few decades of the event? Who is telling lies? Who are the people that were willing to die? What right do you have to do this, Jesus? Well, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. Then you'll know what authority I have. Now, our third point from this passage is that as the temple of God, Jesus is misunderstood. We know that the Jews didn't get it in verse 20, but neither did his disciples. In verse 22, after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. In other words, up to that point, even the disciples hadn't clearly understood what Jesus was on about. And that's very important for us to realise, because they belonged to a culture. They expected that the Messiah would come and be powerful, that he would turf out the Romans, he would raise the banner of Jewish history again. He'd restore the kingdom of David and Solomon. He would rule powerfully. But a king who would be a suffering servant? Well, they didn't have the category in which to file that. It didn't compute. Have a look in Matthew chapter 16. Matthew 16. Beginning in verse 13. Matthew 16 and verse 13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do you say that the Son of Man is?" And let me tell you, there's no more important question that could be asked of you. Who do you say the Son of Man is? It's a question we've all got to answer. None of us will escape not answering. Who is he? And they replied, "Well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah, or maybe one of the prophets. But what about you?" See, Jesus is asking us, what about you? Who do you say I am? Well, Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah. You are the Son of the living God." And then after he said that, Jesus starts to talk about his impending death. Verse 21, "From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem." Must go up to Jerusalem. "And when I'm there, suffer many things at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law. And then he must be killed. And on the third day, he'd be raised to life." And Peter heard what he said, and he took Jesus aside and said, "Look, I just want to have a word with you. Come over here, I've got something to say." And he began to tell Jesus, "Oh, what are you talking about? This is never going to happen to you, Lord." And Jesus turned to Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me. You don't have in mind the concerns of God. You don't have in mind the plan of God for what is going to take place at Jerusalem. You've only got merely human concerns." I wonder, is it possible for us to be right in one area of theology and to be wrong in another part? Is that possible? Peter was quite right in one area, wasn't he? Jesus said, "Who am I?" "Well, you're the Messiah. You are the Son of the living God." Tick. Correct. You're right. "Oh, and by the way, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and die and be resurrected on the third day." "Oh, no, you're not." Cross. Wrong. See, at this point, even the disciples didn't understand. While everybody thought that God was losing, while the disciples were full of gloom and despair during those 3 days that Jesus was in the tomb, God had actually triumphed. But here, you see, in John 2, they didn't understand. Now, what this means is that coming to faith, these disciples, it's never like our coming to faith. Their coming to a full Christian faith is always bound up in the need to understand the cross and the resurrection. Their coming to faith was, in a sense, always conditional. Yes, they had an idea that Jesus was the Messiah, but that doesn't mean by Messiah that they understood exactly what we understand. And they didn't fully understand what it was that Jesus had come to do. What we understand has now been shaped by the event that's taken place in Jerusalem It's shaped by our understanding that the Messiah is not only the king, but he is also the suffering servant. But they didn't see that. They didn't grasp that. And for them to come to full Christian faith took the passage of time until that great event of the cross and resurrection actually happened, and then they believed. Then they could look back and see what Jesus had been saying. And the Gospels record that element for us. And then, of course, we know the Spirit came upon them at Pentecost, and then we can say, well, they're Christians in the way that we might think of the term. Now, that means we shouldn't be reading the Gospels primarily to give us a profile of how you come to faith. That's not what they're intended to show us. Because their coming to faith is always going to be different to ours, because that was pre-cross and pre-resurrection. Ours is post those events. The Gospels aren't given to us for those reasons. The Gospels are primarily there to reveal Jesus. That's what they're there for. To reveal who he is. And our study of the Gospels, in that sense, should always be Christ-centered. Always focused on who he is and what he has done, and what he says he is. In that sense, it calls us to faith, and it calls us to discipleship. But the disciples themselves, well, they didn't understand at this point. Finally, some misunderstood Jesus, the temple of God, because all they wanted really was some kind of power religion from him. Notice how John ends this up. He could have put these verses anywhere, but he puts them right here, right at the end of this passage about the temple and before we're introduced to Nicodemus. John 2 and verse 23. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. So here are people that see some of the signs, see some of the miracles that Jesus is performing, and they believe. But Jesus does not treat their belief as true belief. And what you see throughout John's Gospel is that there is belief, and there is belief. There's a belief that Jesus views as being enduring and persevering and genuine. And then there is a belief that Jesus views as being spurious and interested only in superficial things. And so here people see a number of the wonderful signs that Jesus performed. They see what he is doing and they believe in his name, but Jesus will not entrust himself to them. And in that context, what John is telling us is, look, these people were fascinated by Jesus' power. They were fascinated by the miracles. They were fascinated by the signs, but they too hadn't understood. They too hadn't understood that this temple must be destroyed and had to be raised again. They hadn't come to grips with the fact that the Messiah had to be a suffering servant. And of course, that can be true for us too. We can be fascinated by Jesus' power. We can be fascinated by the miracles. We can be fascinated by the signs and yet not understand that we have to persevere in order to be a follower of Jesus. Not only the Jesus who is king and provider, but also the Jesus who is the suffering servant, the one who dies for us. And then the one who calls upon us to take up our cross and follow him. And in those difficult moments, when taking up our cross can be hard, it's important to remind ourselves that in John chapter 2, it's not the final biblical allusion to Jesus being the temple of God. There's something further that we can keep our minds set upon when we are struggling and having difficulties and trials and temptations. There's something we can keep our vision on. Because the final illusion of the temple is in the closing chapters of the book of Revelation. Revelation 21. This is where John sees a new heaven and a new earth. And he describes it full of symbolic terms. But notice what's not going to be there. Revelation 21 and verse 22. I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple. Now, isn't that wonderful? In other words, there's no longer any point in a conventional structure with some kind of mediation. There's no need for a temple and the priesthood. You don't have to approach God through all of these structures, because Jesus himself is the temple. And now, in the new heaven and the new earth, he is himself the temple in its unshielded glory. We can know God personally and intimately. You see, all of the knowledge of God that we have now is mediated knowledge. We don't see Jesus face to face. We can't yet. But he makes himself known to us through his Spirit. We feel the Spirit's promptings within us that push us forward towards holiness and makes us ashamed of doing things that are wrong. You know, that firm belief the Spirit implants in us and makes us orientate our lives towards the future, so that we too, along with all of God's people down through history, cry out, "Come, Lord Jesus." The Spirit places that within us. And things that we used to love, well, we don't love them quite so much now because we have other priorities. So we know something about the Spirit's work inside each one of us, but we still don't see God face to face. But one day we will. And there's no temple in that place. There's no longer a need for mediation, because the Lord God himself and the Lamb are the temple. So all of this is part of the progress of God's plan, his plan of redemption, right through to the very last day. And so we understand from where we've come. There's an old covenant structure of religion that has told us all kinds of things about what God requires. A sacrifice, a meeting place, holiness, a priesthood, death for sin. And then climactically, there has come Jesus himself, the temple of God, where we meet with God directly. And already we have eternal life because of this one, given by grace, received by faith. But now ultimately we see that it is climaxed at the very end of history, in the new heaven and the new earth. The home of the righteous is seeing God face to face, having that intimate relationship with God. Sometimes it's been called the beatific vision, but what it means is we are now in close proximity to, we now have that kind of intimate relationship with God. A relationship that's unblemished, untarnished, where we see the transcendent glory of God in all of its fullness. All of life, all of history is resolved and fulfilled and consummated within the knowledge and the presence of God. That is the gospel message that we preach to the world. And our ministry, Our proclamation of this good news is only possible because Jesus is the temple of God, and it's only possible because Jesus, as the temple of God, died and rose again. So let's faithfully take that message out to the world. Let's shout out that message loud and clear, that the one who was destroyed and who rose again on the third day has included all of humanity in that great work. Every single human being has been included in what Christ has done. No one left out, no one excluded. Every single person has been included in that great work of God. And let me tell you, that is good news indeed.